This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 81 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Today, we are going to be discussing Vulcan Katras in Star Trek, inspired by episode 6 of Star Trek Discovery, known as Lethe. Mike, this topic was your idea. What about Lethe inspired you to want to talk about Katras today?
Well, frankly, I'm feeling very centered, Zachary, and Discovery has me contemplating Vulcan philosophy. After watching the episode Lethe this week, I mentioned to you that we should talk about the Vulcan Katra pretty soon, and you suggested that there was no time like the present. So Discovery is not the first iteration of Star Trek to add to the mythos of Katras in the Star Trek universe, but I have to say that it did really raise some interesting questions about the essence of the Vulcan mind and maybe our own living spirit as well. I think some notable philosophers like Descartes will probably make their way into the conversation today. I know your intuitions are always attuned to the more abstract fields of philosophy, so I think this is going to be right up your alley.
Well, this is one of these topics that's so unique to Star Trek, right? Vulcan Katras are a thing in-universe, right? In the Star Trek universe, Vulcans have Katras. So there's kind of two problems here. What does it mean in-universe? Is there a good, consistent, coherent in-universe explanation for what a Katra is and how it functions and kind of what the rules are around it, the in-universe metaphysics? And then you can ask the deeper real-life question, what does that mean for the philosophy of mind? Is there some connection we can draw between what a Vulcan Katra means in Star Trek and what our minds are here in the real world, you know, in the philosophy of mind and the various philosophical explanations for the nature of the mind or mental properties? And is there some relationship between the two? Does one shed light on the other? Or is the very idea of a Vulcan Katra so in-universe that it doesn't really have any direct philosophical application here for us in the real world with how the real world seems to function? Because on the surface, I think you can say, well, we don't have Katras, right? It doesn't work like that for humans like it seems to for Vulcans. So I think that would be an overly quick rejection of this concept of a Vulcan Katra, because one plausible, at least for some philosophers, philosophy of mind is mind-body dualism, the idea that the mm-hmm. physical world and the mental world are different in some way, either different substances or different properties. And that's only one theory of mind. There are other physicalist theories that reject the idea of dualism, but that's one plausible philosophy of mind, one of the big theories of philosophy of mind here in the real world and real philosophy of mind. So what's the connection between the two, and does one shed light on the other? Or can we just reject the notion out of hand as inconsistent and either inconsistent, even in universe, maybe it's inconsistent. Like there's no good coherent explanation of what a Katra is and how it functions inside, even inside the Star Trek universe. And if there is something approaching a consistent theory of a Katra, what does that mean for us in the real world with how the real world seems to function, actual philosophy of mind and the nature of our own minds?
What's really great, Zachary, within Star Trek, we have a growing body of information to really draw from for this discussion. Stamets began an interesting contemplation within the episode Lethe that I just mentioned, to which Captain Lorca says, "We have exactly no time to discuss the metaphysical implications." Well, Zachary, we have plenty of time to have that discussion right here, right now, all for the enjoyment of our listeners, at least I hope. And I want to begin by inviting all of you listening to go to the Babel Conference, our listeners only discussion group on Facebook. Find the show thread and continue this conversation. Share your thoughts. Share your katra if you so desire. Your mind to our minds, and comment until our minds become one.
See, Mike, this is where Captain Lorca and I differ. I tend to take the Star Trek The Next Generation Captain Picard approach to things. Like, we could be in the middle of a crisis, and I'd be like, okay, let's pause. Let's go to the observation lounge and have a philosophical discussion about the metaphysical implications of everything going on around us. Captain Picard would take the time to do that. Lorca's like, we don't have time to discuss the metaphysics of this.
And, you know, I just completely off track, but to your point, I think that's intentional. I think that they are intentionally drawing differences between Lorca and Captain Picard, because you're absolutely right. Captain Picard would want to go have the discussion. Lorca's much too practical. And I think that was a statement. I think that was a statement by the writers of Discovery saying Lorca is not anything like any other captain we've seen inside the Star Trek universe.
I'm not even 100% convinced he even knows the meaning of metaphysics. Personally, you know, is that a little harsh? I don't know.
No,
I don't want to hurt Lorca's feelings. You know, he's already about to lose command. So,
Lorca's much too practical. But here's the thing that really captured my attention. There's the scene in which Lorca and Michael Burnham are talking to Stamets about how to reach Sarek, who's unconscious inside a nebula and he's dying. His katra, which he shared with Michael as a child to save her life, is reaching out again, but has rejected Michael's presence inside Sarek's mind because he's hiding this really deep, dark secret. And I don't want to throw too many spoilers out there, but, you know, he
almost busts out into song. Hey, hey, you get off of
get
my
out
cloud.
Of my head.
I was thinking the Rolling Stones, Get Off of My Cloud, but you had a different song. Yeah. You had a Billy Ocean in mind, I think.
It's like Billy Ocean, yeah. Get out of my dreams and into my shuttlecraft. But yeah, he goes and literally punches Michael Burnham out of his head. You know, he's out of his head over her, I guess. You know, so much for, you know, me katra, su katra. But I digress. The idea is presented to create, and I love this, a synthetic mind meld augment, or what Burnham calls a neural enhancer. And I love that we can science something in the past that in the future Star Trek universe still holds such a sacred mystique. So Groovy Stamets, the Mushroom Man, says, quote, "We boost your neural impulses to reconnect with Sarek's katra, then pump those same signals into your noggin, and voila, Sarek vision. This katra stuff is way cool. An uncharted superhighway connecting all of consciousness and life," end quote. I love it.
Okay, so right off the bat, we're up against these two questions that I have, like, What is a katra in universe, right? How exactly does this work? I had kind of assumed that a katra, and by extension, mind melds and katra-like communication, are all done through some sort of, you know, spooky dualism, where a katra is like this non-physical entity, like this, you know, that the housing of your consciousness in some non-physical, non-bodily kind of way. And here we seem to be implying that communication with someone's katra happens more through some sort of, you know, omnipresent, pervasive, possibly physical, maybe not even dualist, but like actual, some physical part of the physical universe, you know, subspace or other type of connection, you know, a vast network between consciousnesses, but nothing that is dualist per se.
Well, this is the thing that really interests me about this. And I think Stamets really raises the philosophical question that I imagine we're going to hover around quite a bit here in this conversation. He describes the katra, this consciousness, as a superhighway that connects all of consciousness and all of life. And I find that fascinating.
Do you think he used to be roommates with Al Gore?
I think he's definitely spent way too much time among the mushrooms, but
it's like it's such an interesting callback to the 90s. It's like, we're, you know, the internet is the information superhighway. Like, no, this is the Vulcan Katrick superhighway.
But I love inside this episode, we're creating a device. You know, this is something that up until now has been highly spiritualized in the Star Trek universe. And we see plenty of examples going all the way back to the original series where we are transferring katras. And we always, at least in terms of the Star Trek universe, have always kind of enshrouded that inside of this very...
It's mystical, I mean.
Yeah.
They give a kind of a mystical, if not in a mystical interpretation of it, at least a mystical connotation of it.
Yeah, there's this kind of mystical gravitas to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And even as late as Enterprise, we know that, you know, hey, this Katra thing is nothing to be messed around with, and you need somebody who has experience. And so
I see, Mike, I think Stamets actually got it wrong. Actually, it's the Medichlorians that allow Katric communication to take place.
No. That's the wrong franchise.
Oh, wrong franchise. Sorry. But okay, here, I guess this is my point that I want to make. I see what you're describing as an attempt to kind of naturalize this mystical interpretation of Vulcan Katras, taking something that seems spooky and metaphysical or non-physical, spooky dualist, and trying to give a scientific explanation for it. You know, whatever pervasive network of whatevers it is that connects these consciousnesses together. Just like, no, really, to make an analogy, just like in episode one of Star Wars, mm-hmm. you got the Midichlorians as an attempt to naturalize the seemingly metaphysical thing, the Force. But I mentioned both of those examples because I think this is what happens in philosophy of mind. We have this sense that our mind is different from our body. It has different properties like consciousness and beliefs and intentions. But that's spooky dualist if you read it that way, right? We want to kind of naturalize that. So there are these alternative philosophies of mind like reductionism, or identity theory, emergence theory, different theories that attempt to kind of naturalize what could be read as spooky and metaphysical. I see both of those, you know, this attempt to naturalize Katras and the Midichlorians in episode one of Star Wars in line with this overall lack of satisfaction we get out of spooky dualistic explanations for things.
Well, I think that's what I find fascinating about this episode of Discovery because, yeah, it does seem like they are trying to naturalize this idea of Katra, which I find a little awkward for me as a fan. It's a little awkward because, again, fast forward to the TOS time period or even beyond that, and it's something that is still, I mean, even in the time of Next Generation, Voyager, Deep Space Nine, it's something that has a sort of, I'd describe it as a religious gravitas, a metaphysical mystery that seems to be shrouded around this. And it's something that largely feels religious and spiritual, but here we are 10 years before the TOS time period, and we're sciencing it and we're naturalizing it. And that seems a little odd to me, but I think it does add to the conversation when you're breaking this down and trying to discover what it is and what it means for us in our own universe.
But so much of how we define ourselves is in terms of, as humans here in the real world, we define ourselves in terms of our special, unique cognitive abilities, as opposed to everything around us, as opposed to all the lower life forms, as opposed to all the inanimate objects. We're the sentient ones, right? So that's so much of a part of who we are. We really desperately want there to be something special about consciousness. And the danger with naturalizing consciousness is that you eliminate its specialness, right? If consciousness is just defined in terms of whatever's going on in my brain, you know, neurons firing in certain ways and very complex patterns, and that results in what we call consciousness now. If it works that way for all the other life forms too, then they have something similar to consciousness. If it's merely a part of the natural world, that knocks the religious connotation of consciousness completely out of the way. It reduces our special place in the natural world. Mm-hmm. It really kind of knocks us down a peg if you read it that way. Although there's still a question of degree. We could still be more conscious than other life forms, and certainly we're more conscious than than inanimate objects, right? So, but it, that sort of ultra special, you know, center of the universe connotation that we often have with our own consciousness, I think that would knock us down a little bit of a peg. So I think, you know, we do have an iron in this fire. We want to maintain our unique status compared to beings that aren't as sentient as we are, and or not sentient at all. And the challenge then is to give some sort of account of consciousness that really does preserve that special nature that we do seem to have. I think you'd be naive, I think, not to look around and say, hey, I'm more conscious than my podcast microphone. I'm more conscious than this computer screen in front of me. I'm more conscious than the, you know, insects flying around out my garden out there, right? You know, we're more conscious than those things. Clearly, I think you'd be denying the obvious to deny that, I think. But so the challenge is to give some sort of naturalist explanation that really is a satisfactory explanation of all the things we associate with consciousness while respecting the things that are genuinely unique about consciousness. But, you know, there's the danger that you could knock religion out in one fell swoop, and you could knock our special place in the universe out in one fell swoop. And so we definitely have an iron in this fire, I think.
I agree completely. You know, my mind goes to Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. A TOS era movie, and I think that was really the first time that we really got anything significant on this idea of Katras. Now, we got an introduction to it in the episode Return to Tomorrow from the original series, but it wasn't really fleshed out in any real way. It was almost if you blinked, you would probably.
That's such a confusing episode. Like, you can't keep track of who's in what in that episode.
But in that
wait, they're in Spock's head. Now they're in the globes. Now they're in someone else. Now, like, what is going on in this episode? Everyone is not where they're supposed to be. It's an incredibly confusing episode if you're not paying attention.
Yeah. Well, those are great non-Vulcan examples, parallels, if you will. We had Talaysa, Hennock, and Sargon in Return to Tomorrow. And we discussed that episode, by the way, in detail on show number, I think it was 39. It was entitled Something Borrowed, Something Blue. So check it out in our back catalog by visiting the iTunes store or our website. But there was also the transfer of Spock's consciousness to Nurse Christine Chapel. So that was really the first time, and he says in the episode that he basically transferred his essence into her. But we almost miss it because it seems almost normal, Zachary, if I can say that, in light of the fact of these three aliens who are bouncing around between little light balls and Captain Kirk.
I'm going to run the risk of embarrassing myself that I can't remember this detail. Do they actually use the term Katra inside that episode? Does Spock say, I transferred my Katra to, or it just happens, they don't really explain?
No, it just happens. I think he uses the word essence, if my memory serves.
Sure, same difference. What's a Katra if not an essence of consciousness?
Yeah, he didn't call it a Katra. Sure. I don't think we heard the word Katra until Star Trek III. That's when we really get an explanation. Star Trek II. At the very end of that, he transfers his Katra to Bones. And, you know, it's funny. I remember watching that for the very first time in the movie theater and wondering, you know, when he says, remember, I wondered what that was all about. I didn't really pay any attention. And then it becomes this huge thing, and it becomes a premises for Star Trek III. And suddenly the Vulcan Katra is very much a part of the mythos of the Vulcan race. It's very much a part of who they are. But inside Star Trek III, we get to see the Fal Tor Pan, or the refusion, the reintegration. And you know, it's funny because during that period of time, you know, the home computer was kind of a new thing. And as Zachary being an old Radio Shack guy, and as well as I'm an old Radio Shack guy, we appreciate, you remember the 5.25 floppies?
I do.
That's kind of how I pictured what was going on inside that scene. You know, they've got this empty computer. Spock is this empty computer, and they've got a 5.25 floppy with all of his memories and experiences on him. And that's been loaded into Bones.
I kind of wonder how many of those old 5.25-inch floppies it would take to hold a Katra.
for Spock, that's probably a lot. But, you know, we see that conducted in a there's this big, grandiose religious ceremony where they speak native Vulcan, and, you know, this again, this gravitas to the whole thing is huge and mystical. And we know from Enterprise, T'Pau says to one of the other Serenites, you know, we've got to be careful here. We can't, you know, I'm paraphrasing, you can't mess around with Katras.
To go back to the 5 1/4 inch floppy metaphor, make sure you, knock out the little read write tab.
Exactly. Exactly.
Make sure you don't accidentally download someone's Katra.
Yeah, you don't want to accidentally download somebody's Katra. So, yeah.
Okay, so we're making light of this, obviously, and making a few jokes along the way, and that's fine because this is funny stuff. But I feel like there's something to this because you grew up in the 70s. I grew up in the 80s. And with that, I think comes certain metaphors for things that are familiar and friendly to us. These computational metaphors, the idea that you could take someone's consciousness and upload it, download it, put it on a floppy disk, you know, and here in the 21st century, it's like send it out into the cloud, right? These computational metaphors are familiar. So that's one of the fundamental questions I have. Does a Katra have to be sort of spooky, metaphysical, and dualist? Or can you give a more naturalistic, maybe even a computational reading of what a Katra is? Is it more like an information download and a little less like spooky and metaphysical? You know, if Spock, when he mind melds with McCoy in Star Trek II, you know, is he essentially taking the information that makes up his consciousness? Not any sort of spooky metaphysical thing, not some non-physical substance, right? Not a soul, but the information that defines who Spock is, you know, as if you could write it onto a floppy disk and uploading that into McCoy's brain. Is that a better reading of a Katra than the spooky metaphysical interpretation of a Katra?
You know, I and we were making light, and we can laugh and joke about that, and that's...
I'm going to go uncheck all my read-write tabs right now.
Yeah. That's true. No. But all kidding aside, I think it was Tuvok inside of Workforce accused his abductors of stealing his Katra. So again, this is something that...
Someone stole my floppy disk.
Somebody stole my floppy disk. But you think about that for a minute. I mean, there is a danger here of having your Katra stolen from you. There is the possibility. We know that there are dangers linked with transferring the Katra. We know from the Forge trilogy that a Katra can actually reject the transfer, which can cause issues.
Well, you have to format your floppy disk correctly in order for it to properly take a Katra.
But inside Star Trek III, though, Zachary, there is Lexarin, which is a future pharma solution to counteract one of the possible side effects of a Katra transfer, which is multiple personality problems. So there's a lot of things going on with it within this concept of Katra that I think is fascinating. I think it deserves, you know, serious discovery. I don't. Again, you know, think about Lexarin being a future pharma solution to counteract. So I don't know if it's been cleared by the FDA to treat what Archer referred to as a mind meld hangover. But I mean, we have pharma solutions in the future so evidently it's common to transfer Katras, and they're aware of the side effects. One of them being, you know, multiple personality issues, which Bones was experiencing when he had Spock's Katra.
I think for me, the thing that's most interesting, the fact that we can have this discussion about the nature of the Vulcan Katra, you know, is it spooky and metaphysical and dualist? Can you describe it in terms of information transfer, some other reading that we have of it that we haven't talked about yet? All of these different possibilities are the types of arguments we give about our own consciousness here in the real world, right? We can say, oh, what is the mind? Is it dualist? Is it non-physical, different and distinct from my body in some way, either in substance or in terms of its properties? Is it defined in terms of information? Are these computational metaphors, like, you know, the information that makes up my identity? is that a useful way of describing the nature of our own consciousness or not? Could I, in theory, duplicate myself by taking that information and transferring it somewhere else? You know, in the 80s, it would have been on a floppy disk. In the 90s, it would have been like, I'm going to put it on a hard drive. In the 21st century, it's like, I'm going to upload myself to the cloud.
Exactly.
But whatever it is, right, is that a helpful metaphor for understanding all of the things that need explanation in our consciousness? Or is that an unfruitful metaphor? Does that leave something out? And I guess, you know, my worry about those kinds of readings is they sound plausible because we've made so much progress in terms of technology, right? Oh, of course we can, you know, we're eventually going to be able to handle so much information, whether in terms of storage or in terms of transfer or in terms of processing power, where we're going to replicate what's going on in the brain and boom, computers will be conscious and we'll be able to transfer our consciousnesses to machines. And it's a very kind of, you know, sexy, convincing story, you know, for our technologically progressive world. But the fundamental question is, does that leave something out? Is there something that consciousness does that can't be encapsulated in that kind of approach? I think you could plausibly say that no amount of information storage or information transfer captures the subjective experience of consciousness. You might be able to transfer information, but where is the subjectivity? Where is the first person perspective that we normally associate with consciousness? And does that, so we can run this reasoning with Vulcan Khatras. When Spock transfers his Khatra into McCoy, does Spock's first person subjective point of view, his consciousness in that sense, not just the information that makes up Spock, but his first person consciousness, his first person window into the world, does that travel into McCoy? Do we literally have, you know, first person Spock inside of McCoy alongside McCoy, or a hybrid of Spock and McCoy? But does the consciousness actually go along with the Khatra transfer, or is it just an information transfer?
Well, that's the really interesting thing here, Zachary. If you go strictly on Star Trek III, I think you are left with the impression that this is an information transfer, something that resembles that 5 1/4 floppy that we were talking about before. But then we get to the Enterprise era, and I honestly can't believe that all this time, as a fan and as someone who has thought about these things, that I have more or less ignored what was going on inside this three-part. We had three episodes inside the fourth season of Enterprise. Those episodes are The Forge, Awakening, and Kirshara, the Forge trilogy that I mentioned earlier, in which there's this really interesting transfer of Surok, who is the father of Vulcan logic. His Khatra is being carried by a man named Siren, who melded with a Khatra Ark. Now, a Khatra Ark is a vessel that in the Star Trek universe can contain a Vulcan's Khatra, his mind, his living essence. And it's like a Khatra in a can. We were joking in the turbo lift about going to a supermarket, and if I want to learn more about astrophysics, do I go buy a Khatra in a can?
A Khatra six pack,
exactly.
Okay, I want to stop you right there though and ask a question. So, insofar as a Khatra is separable from the body and it can be contained in a vessel, a Khatric arc in some way, the fundamental question for me is, is that Khatra conscious? Is there a consciousness inside that Khatric arc? Or is it merely some sort of information stored? Does the little vessel now have a first person perspective into the world because a Khatra is there?
So to my point, up until watching Discovery episode Lethe, I had always viewed the Khatra as more informational, something on a floppy disk that can be uploaded, downloaded, whatever. But I ignored what was going on inside of these three episodes of Enterprise, and that is a person-to-person conversation that is ongoing between Archer and Surok of Vulcan. Here's the thing. Siren dies inside those episodes, inside the very first episode, in fact. And he is carrying Surak's Katra, which he transfers to Jonathan Archer. Now, here's the great thing, Zachary. Archer describes what he calls a mind meld hangover, which I think is hilarious. But he later reports that he feels more centered. So clearly there are some benefits to receiving the Katra of someone like Surak. He benefited from that. By the way, he could also perform a Vulcan neck pinch. So, you know, he learns how to do a Vulcan neck pinch. So for all the people out there that think the Vulcan neck pinch is about the pressure, it's not. It's all about technique. And he learns that technique from possessing Surak's consciousness. But he has conversation with this long-dead Vulcan. So
is it real, genuine conversation, or is it the illusion of conversation?
Well, in light of what we just saw in the Discovery episode Lethe, I think that's open for debate.
See, actually, did you hear the one about the two Vulcans who were stuck in their Katrak arcs for 7 years? One of them says to the other, "Ponfar was a lot more fun before I died." What a frustrating experience that would be. Talk about being imprisoned in your own body. They're being imprisoned in a Katrak arc for 7 years. But that's, again, the fact that Jonathan Archer has a conversation does not necessarily settle the issue, right? If in order for it to be a real, genuine conversation, there has to be another consciousness on the other side of that conversation responding with real, you know, impromptu, lifelike responses, right? It can't just be the appearance of that, because it could just be information. You can explain the same thing with information transfer, right? All of, Surak's experiences get transferred into Captain Archer. Captain Archer's mind formulates a persona that he, you know, in his own mind has this interaction with, and there's no actual separate consciousness there to have a conversation with. It's all kind of an illusion. The same phenomena would occur, right, in that situation. So what do we have that really settles the issue, that really firmly establishes that a Katra is conscious, even if it's separate from the body, even if it is housed in someone else, in other words, is it not just an illusion?
Well, again, I think Discovery attempts to answer that very question, Zachary. We have two episodes of Discovery in which we have thus far examined the Vulcan Katra battle at the binary stars. We discover that Sarek, not to be confused with Surak of Vulcan, but Sarek has transferred a part of his Katra into Michael Burnham in order to save her life. The after effect of that is that they are able to communicate with one another across light years, across space.
It's very Mork and Mindy. Mork Culligorson.
Nanu, nanu.
Nanu, nanu. So again, I think, is Discovery helping or hurting here? Because I feel like it's trying to give an explanation, but I feel like it's actually creating more problems than it solves, right? Not only do we have to worry about whether Katras are conscious in the first place, but now we have to worry about whether they're divisible. We have to worry about whether she has part of Sarek's consciousness. We have to worry about how this long distance communication can take place between Katras or between consciousnesses. It's all tied up with this infinite network of whatevers that are binding everything together in this midichlorian kind of way. And I feel like it's made it vastly more complicated rather than actually explaining anything.
Well, again, I think we look at the evidence. Again, we know from the Forge trilogy, those three episodes that I just mentioned from Enterprise, that a Katra could resist its own transfer. So there's a consciousness there that can say, "Hey, hold on, put on the brakes. I'm not okay with this. This isn't groovy."
They're like, could you give me a slightly younger body to go into, or maybe make me a little better looking before you put me in another body?
Well, wasn't that Talaysa and Henoch? Didn't they kind of have that same sort of issue? They didn't like those android bodies that were being built for them.
Do you remember, there's an old episode of The Twilight Zone, right? Do you remember this? It's, I know this is in the Wayback Machine. You know, we're talking early 1960s here. But there's an episode of The Twilight Zone where this old couple, they walk into the body shop of some variety and they're shopping for new bodies because they've solved that problem. They figured out a transfer consciousnesses. And it turns out that they only have enough money for one of them. So then they have to decide which one gets the new body and which one has to stay old.
I do remember that.
I think it was the Twilight. It might have been Outer Limits, but I'm pretty sure that was the Twilight Zone. I think it was Twilight Zone. Yeah. So, you know, again, is there like a fee for doing Patrick transfers? You know, is what's her name? Is it T'Pau?
Yeah, T'Pau. Well, you know, it could be.
Is T'Pau making a little money on the side?
It could be like wedding chapels in Vegas. You know, they're kind of these seedy cities on Vulcan where, you know, you can go and you've got a Vulcan priest dressed like Elvis who, you know, we'll transfer Katras around for you if you want to, and for a fee, of course. And it comes with free tokens for the casino. But this is the thing, Zachary, and this is the thing that I think throws me a little bit. This isn't unique to Vulcans. We've seen this a few times in the Star Trek universe. I mentioned Return to Tomorrow, Thalesa, Hennek, Sargon in that episode. Obviously had the ability to transfer their consciousness into those little, for lack of a
receptacle,
better way,
some
light ball.
Yeah, some Vulcan-like
yeah,
way.
Yeah, some mm-hmm. kind of Vulcan-like way that they were able to put their consciousness inside those little balls of light. Rayo Vantica from Deep Space Nine's The Passenger. He's able to transfer his consciousness into Julian Bashir. Tyrion to Kes comes to mind. I think that was Voyager. I believe that episode was called Warlord. Again, was able to transfer his consciousness into Kes. Similarly, in The Schizoid Man from Star Trek Next Generation, Ira Graves, Grandpa, discovers a way to transfer his consciousness into Data's technology.
To know him is to love him is to know him?
To know, yes, yes, absolutely. He was able to transfer his consciousness into Data's technology, which was later transferred to a computer. So this isn't a problem that's unique for Vulcans, or at least an ability that's... I mean, I believe Ira Graves is a human being. He's discovered a way to transfer his living consciousness into something else. So I think within the Star Trek universe, I think what we're saying is that our consciousness, our mind, is our essence. It's living. It is alive and continues to live beyond our physical limitations.
Well, see, the examples you're giving there are slightly different. So
they are.
Like you, I had always read the Vulcan interpretation of this as very metaphysical, almost dualist, something non-physical, some sort of entity that, you know, is their soul or their essence is transferable from body to body to body or into a receptacle of some sort. You have a fundamental problem like you have with all dualist theories of how exactly the non-physical thing is connected to a physical thing. How is the Katra bound to a body? How is the Katra contained inside of an object if it's not physical, right? So it has the same problem that Descartes ran into in trying to explain why the mind and the body are conjoined together in some way, even though one's physical and the other's not, and they don't have any properties in common. So that's how I'd always previously interpreted Vulcans. But with Ira Graves in Star Trek The Next Generation, I had always read that as more like information transfer, right? If you can upload yourself into Data or upload yourself into a computer, then that sounds a little more like this computational approach to consciousness, this idea that, you know, I mean, if you look at the parts inside of a computer, you've got the information storage part, your hard drive, mm-hmm. your floppy drive, or your cloud storage. And then you've got the processing power part, your central processor, your CPU, or Data's positronic brain, right? And the conjunction of the two is what makes a computer work. You know, the processor needs to draw upon information and pass information back and forth, perform operations on it, and spit out outputs based on certain inputs. But the information has to be stored somewhere, and something has to process it and spit out an output. That's essentially how a computer works. And so what you're kind of describing there with Ira Graves, I think, is solving the information part of that, right? Whatever information that Ira Graves whatever information defines Ira Graves' consciousness, you can transfer that into Data and let Data's positronic brain handle the information processing part, mm-hmm. or let the Enterprise computer handle the information processing part. But what does it process? The information that makes up Ira Graves' nature, his memories, his experiences. I think there's a serious question of whether the person goes along with that, right? If you're merely transferring the information but relying on something else to do all the information processing, in what sense does the subjective first-person experience go along with that process? I think it's much more plausible to me that if you take a dualist reading or a metaphysical reading of a Vulcan Katra, that thing, whatever it is conscious. So when it goes somewhere else, the consciousness goes along with it. The first person subjective experiential component goes wherever the Katra goes. It goes where it goes. But I feel like the information transfer reading, it's a lot more questionable or specious to think that the subjectivity, the conscious experience goes along with it, because we're talking about mere information transfer. You could say that, well, if information is being processed in the exact same way and consciousness is some sort of an emergent property, then whether, you know, the neurons in your brain are doing the information processing, or whether Data's positronic brain is doing the information processing, or whether the Enterprise computer is doing the information processing, if that information processing is being done in the exact same way, then the very same emergent consciousness would emerge out of it. So there's no actual difference, as long as the information processing is sort of numerically identical, that it's functioning in the exact same way, then the same consciousness would emerge. I don't know which of those is most plausible, either in the Star Trek universe or here in the real world. I think, you know, here in the real world, you have the problem of dualism, right? If you have mind and body and they're different substances, or even if they're just different properties, why are they conjoined together? How does one emerge mm-hmm. from the other? Mm-hmm. Why are they conjoined together? Why do they seem like they're bound together in some way? And Descartes gave a real, you know, crappy answer to that question by saying, oh, well, there's this gland inside the brain, the pineal gland, and that's where they're conjoined together. And that's a terrible answer. It's a non-answer, right? And so a Katra would have the same problem. Like, why is a Katra bound, you know, whether it's Spock? Well, since we're talking about Discovery, let's talk about Sarek. Why is Sarek's Katra normally bound to his body, contained there? It doesn't seem like it goes anywhere else. Then under some very special circumstances, something happens and his Katra either gets fragmented, I'm not sure what that means, or it goes somewhere else, you know, into Michael Burnham, or part of it goes into Michael Burnham, or it's floating out there in space and Michael Burnham can, you know, commune with it, you know, in a very, you know, Star Warsy force talk kind of way. She uses her midichlorians. So that's one problem. And then if it's not that, if it's just the information transfer part, when a Vulcan dies, the information that defines their memories and experiences and, you know, those, if that's what the essence of someone is, the informational component, if that gets transferred to any new medium, do we have any real reason for thinking that the subjective conscious experience goes with it? I think, you know, in terms of retaining the consciousness, if consciousness turns out to be something non-physical, you know, again, either in universe or in the real world, I think you can solve the problem outright and just say, well, if that's what consciousness is, then wherever consciousness goes, then that's where consciousness is. So it doesn't really go away. It just gets moved around, shifted around. Then you have this further problem that's generated of why it seems to be spatially located in certain places, and why it seems bound up with certain physical objects, whether bodies or inanimate objects like the Katra arcs. But if it's not that, if it's not spooky metaphysical, if it's mere information transfer, then that's pretty easy to explain. You know, we transfer information all the time. Mm-hmm. So the notion of how you transfer information is not spooky to us, right? We understand that very well in our 21st century society. What is questionable in that reading of a Katra is whether actual consciousness goes with it, or if it's just some sort of information transfer with no subjectivity, no actual kind of, again, we're kind of using consciousness in irony quotes, but when I say consciousness here, I mean like the first person, like when I'm conscious, I'm I perceive myself and my being, right? I'm aware of my own existence. It's not just that I have memories that are stored in me in some way. It's that I perceive things, and that's what consciousness is. I think you can plausibly say, well, okay, we can solve the information transfer part. We know all about that in our 21st century society, and even in the 24th century society. They're passing subspace information around all the time, right? And the enterprise computer, or the discovery computer in this case, is processing lots of information. So shifting information around is not confusing, but what is confusing to me in that reading of Akatra is why in the heck consciousness goes with it, and it's not just mere information transfer.
Well, that's just a thing for me. I guess I had always looked at this as just mere information transfer, but I think in-universe they were giving us a hint all the time, because it's always been referred to as the living essence of a Vulcan. So there's always been at least that Easter egg, if you will, that this was something more than just an upload of information. Even with Ira Graves inside of Schizoid Man, it wasn't merely just his knowledge. His personality began to emerge in Data. Things like jealousy started to manifest itself, and the wit and humor and raw emotion, love, hate, all of these emotions, all of this essence that we don't necessarily associate with just mere Data began to manifest in Data. So there was something more there than just merely information about, you know, who, what, where, when, why, you know, the things you could have read in any journal, any paper about Ira Graves. There was something more to it than that.
But I think if consciousness is an emergent property based on the unique conjunction of information and processing, you know, to use the computer metaphor full bore here, right? If you take Ira Graves' information and you have the processing power of Data's positronic brain, put them together and you get consciousness emerging out of that, then there might very well be actual consciousness there, as long as it actually works that way. You know, I guess my question is, is that actually a plausible story for how consciousness works? I think you lose something when you talk about consciousness that way personally. I don't see how even the most complex set of information you've got, you know, take the biggest database you can think of here in the real world, you know, pull the fastest supercomputer that you have, run that information through that fastest supercomputer. I don't see why you get subjectivity and first person experience out of that, no matter how complicated of a network you make it. So I feel like the computational metaphor is appealing, but it doesn't actually solve the problem.
You know, something else that, and I don't want to change the subject, but something else that I find fascinating that I didn't think of until just now. Sarek mind melds with Captain Picard. And again, we see some side effects on both men as a result of that. Sarek becomes more centered. Captain Picard, on the other hand, becomes a receptacle for all of these negative emotions. But what Captain Picard is left with at the end of that is at least an essence of Sarek. And at the end of Unification, he offers Spock an opportunity to touch the part of Sarek that was shared with him. And I have noted that in my research on Katras inside of Star Trek, that does seem to be a thing. That at least with Sirach of Vulcan. So let's put this in perspective. So Sirach is in a Katrak arc. He is transferred to Siren, who melds with the Katrak arc. Then Siren transfers Sirach's Katra to Jonathan Archer, and then that Katra is then transferred to T'Pau at the end of the Forge trilogy. But the idea was always there that people would be able to touch the man. So again, I think that speaks to something more than just a piece of information. I don't pick up a book, you know, Let me just... C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite authors. I don't pick up a book and feel like I touch the man. I feel like I gain insights into his mind, but I don't feel like I touch the man.
Only in some sort of metaphorical way.
Exactly, exactly. And maybe it is. It is all... Maybe inside the Star Trek universe, all of this mysticism... All of this terminology they use is more metaphorical. And Zachary, that may be a possibility.
I'm going to run the risk of being philosophically nitpicky and pedantic here. But so undoubtedly, when there's a mind meld in universe, something is left behind in each partner of the mind meld, right?
Absolutely.
Again, we're kind of veering away from Discovery, but that's okay because I think Discovery doesn't give us quite enough to go on here just yet.
Well, this isn't a Discovery discussion. This is a discussion of Katra, so I think we're safe here.
So let's use the example you mentioned a minute ago of Captain Picard and Sarek. They first mind melded in the episode called Sarek and the Next Generation, and we get to see the after effects in the two-parter unification. So something is left behind. They influence each other in some way. So I think there are two ways of reading this. They hinge on the answer to this question. Is a Katra divisible? Does it have parts? Can you leave part of a Katra behind, right? To kind of circle around this a little bit, Descartes raised this issue in his musings on dualism. He basically made the observation that here in the physical world, with physical things are extensible in space and time. They have dimension. And you can divide things in space and time. You can take something of a certain dimension, you can cut it into two, and you can cut that in two, and you can cut that in two, and so on and so forth, right? Things are divisible in the physical world. But non-physical things aren't extensible in space and time, kind of by definition, because they're not part of the physical world. So they're not divisible in any sort of sense. So in Cartesian dualism, the mind as a non-physical substance is not divisible like things that are extended in space and time that have dimension, length and width, and so on and so forth are. So that's one question. Is a Katra, on this non-physical reading of it, this dualist reading of it, is it divisible in some way? Can you leave a part of your Katra behind in someone else's consciousness, in someone else's body, in someone else's Katra, right? Can you leave a piece of it somewhere? And if so, how exactly does that work, and you know all the details that would go along with that? Or is it more like making a copy? So if it's more like information transfer, then you've got a certain set of information that makes up your essence, your memories and your experiences and your, you know, for Vulcans, they're repressed emotions. And when there's a mind meld, is part of that information duplicated, just like you would copy a floppy disk or you would back things up on your cloud storage, right? You know, is a separate copy of that information made, and the information gets copied, but the original is still intact and always present where it always was. So is it more like division, leaving a piece of yourself behind, maybe a little miniature piece of consciousness, whatever that means, maybe a fragment of yourself, you know, again, in this non-physical way, can you take a non-physical thing, divide it into parts and leave part of it with someone else? Is it more like that? Or is it more like making a copy of a floppy disk and forgetting one copy?
Well, I think that's answered inside of these two Discovery episodes in Battle with the Binary Stars. I think it is not just implied, I think it's explicitly stated that Sarek left a part of his Katra. He gave a part of his Katra to Michael Burnham in order to save her life. And then in Lethe...
Because Katras have healing powers too.
Obviously they do.
But they're kind of like in Stargate, they're kind of like the symbiotes that the Gua'uld carry. They have these healing properties. So when you leave a piece of your Katra, you can heal other people on top of everything that they do. to make it extra clear what Katras are.
Well, and Michael Burnham says in Lethe that she wants to do for Sarek what he did for her. And it's kind of funny because our mushroom man, Mr. Stamets, says, oh, like a psychic hit of speed. she's basically going to transfer his Katra back to him in order to, for lack of a better way of putting it, but basically to snap him out of it, to wake him up so that he can hit his beacon.
So I understand that that may be the direction that Discovery wants to go in explaining this, but I still feel like I want to put my Descartes hat back on and ask the hard question, is that really plausible? If a Vulcan Khatra is a non-physical thing, not extensible in space and time, does that mean, like Descartes would say, that it's not divisible because only things that are physical and extended in space and time, part of the physical reality that have dimension, are divisible? So I think Descartes would say it's not possible to divide something non-physical and leave it behind in this spatial kind of way that we think of in terms of physical ordinary objects. That's an inconsistent idea. Given this, it's not enough just to sort of say, well, it works that way in Star Trek, so there, right? Is that a consistent idea or not? Is the question on the table, I think.
But Zachary, you are forgetting Kiri Kintas's first law of metaphysics. Do you know what this is?
Nothing unreal exists, or am I thinking
nothing
of the
unreal exists.
So, that's my point. If this is an inconsistent idea, then that can't be the answer. Or is Descartes wrong that non-physical things are not divisible? That's another answer too, that Descartes was just wrong. I see the difference he's trying to draw between physical things and their essential properties. And for Descartes, the essence of a physical object was to be part of the physical reality, which for him meant located in space and time and having dimension, taking up space, right? That's what it means to be part of the spatial reality. So if it's not that, what's the opposite of that? Non-physical things that don't take up space and time and don't have dimension. So if they literally don't have dimension, then they're not divisible because there's no space in which to divide them. So he would say by definition, non-physical things are not divisible, as opposed to spatial things that are, their essence is to be located in space and time and have dimensions, and a corollary to that, to be divisible.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to me because we don't really know for sure. They don't explicitly spell it out within the Star Trek universe. What happens?
That's what we're for.
What happens to the poor Vulcan who doesn't transfer his Khatra to a Khatra Kark or to another person? Does it just go off into oblivion?
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because this is a conversation that we have in Star Trek 3. Sarek basically tells Captain Kirk, if you haven't mind melded with Spock or anyone else, then everything he was is lost. Like, his Khatra is gone, never to be recovered. And I guess, again, I don't fully understand this, because if it's a non-physical thing, if it's a, you know, again, because I think, especially back in the 80s, we have this very metaphysical reading of that. We haven't got to the naturalistic approach we're taking in Discovery yet. But in that more metaphysical approach, well, why would it go away? It may not be housed in Spock's body. It may not be housed in Captain Kirk's body. We find out it is housed in Dr. McCoy's body, but it might not have been. It might just be floating out there somewhere, right? Either spatially located or not spatially located. But why would it just go away? I don't fully understand Sarek's point there.
No, I think it either, you know, it either goes to
parts unknown,
Vulcan heaven, or Vulcan Hell, otherwise known as the Divine Treasury.
It's not Ferengi. What are you talking about?
Exactly. That's Vulcan Hell, Zachary. The Divine Treasury. Ferengi Heaven is Vulcan Hell. That's my point here. But
yeah,
seriously, though, so it goes off into oblivion. And
Means it exists, but it's not able to be found. Like, it's out there in parts unknown, unable to be recovered. Or is it literally gone? Like, so again, if we've established that Khatras are conscious, even when they're not in a body, which it sounds like you think they have pretty firmly in universe, then if no mind meld takes place and a Vulcan dies, is their Khatra destroyed? Like, there is no consciousness there anymore. Or is there still a Vulcan Khatra with its consciousness intact, just in parts unknown, unable to be recovered because it's not conveniently located in Dr. McCoy anymore?
And I guess that's the $64,000 question. I mean, in the Kelvin timeline, the reason the Vulcans have gone underground during the destruction of Vulcan was to retrieve Surak's Khatra. It was obviously important enough for all of those Vulcans
unknown
to risk their lives in order to save his consciousness from going off into parts unknown. But that's Kelvin universe. I mean,
but it was still conveniently located somewhere.
Yeah, it was in a Kotrick arc.
Right, exactly. So absence a Kotrick arc, absence a Dr. McCoy, a bio-Kotrick arc like Dr. McCoy. That's kind of funny that Dr. McCoy is actually a biological Kotrick arc when you think about it.
Yeah.
Okay. But in the absence of either a non-biological or a biological Kotrick arc, I can't believe this sentence is coming out of my mouth, first of all. So in the absence of a spatially located place to house a Vulcan Katra, does the consciousness itself go away? Is the person not just biologically dead, but is their soul gone and dead for all practical purposes? Or does it still exist just out in parts and unknown, unable to be recovered? We don't know where it is, but it's still... There's still like Spock. I can just picture like Spock just floating around, like almost like part of the Q continuum, outside space and time, not spatially located anywhere, but still present in some way.
I'm feeling something like a Star Trek Stranger Things mashup, where Spock starts playing with the lights on the Enterprise and Captain Kirk strings a bunch of Christmas lights around his quarters and.
That's actually what happened in that episode of The Next Generation when they're those, you know, that episode with the dark matter pockets and the stuff keeps falling off the Enterprise, like the stuff in Captain Picard's desk. Yes. Falls through the desk because a dark matter pocket went through the through the desk. That was actually Spock just messing with him.
I think there's definitely a distinction within the Star Trek universe, Zachary, between doing something like transferring either a part or in whole one's Katra to another person for the purpose of preserving it, for whatever purpose. And what we see in universe where Spock's Katra is actually returned or refused into his person. And that's something more along the lines of resurrection. His Katra is restored through that ritual that we talked about, the Faltor Pan. And I think there's something different there between that ritual and the ritual that we don't really get to see inside the Forge trilogy when Surok's Katra is transferred from Archer to Pal. I think that there are two completely different things going on in those episodes. So I think we can separate those and not really try to draw any conclusions, you know, from comparing those two. I think there are two completely different things going on inside those situations.
Well, I've got two questions that kind of follow up on that. One is whether Vulcans, for all intents and purposes, are essentially immortal. All of them, because they all have Katras, and those Katras are non-physical, and those Katras will persist when the body goes away, either in a Kotrick arc, or in someone else's body, or in parts unknown, right? So, for all intents and purposes, have we established that Vulcans have immortality? That doesn't mean we can recover the Katras, right? Sarek seems to imply that maybe the Katras go off into parts unknown and can't be recovered. But is it, that still sounds like immortality. So do Katras imply immortality? So that's one question. The second question I've got is, does the same reasoning carry over for any sort of dualist view? If Descartes was right that the mind and body are different things, that the mind is a non-physical, non-spatially located, indivisible substance that's different from all the physical stuff in the physical world, does that consciousness ever end? Does that also imply that those non-physical consciousnesses are eternal in some way because they're outside of space and time?
Well, again, I don't think that this is necessarily unique to Vulcans. Again, we have a couple of other examples inside the Star Trek universe.
Or anyone else, right? It doesn't have to just be Vulcans.
Yeah, I think we have a couple of examples inside the Star Trek universe. Now, perhaps whatever knowledge the Vulcans have come by to understand this distinction between their physical life and their living essence, the Vulcan mind.
Like someone gave them a Kotrick decoder ring? Like, what are you talking about?
Well, that's the Kier-Shara. That is the Kier-Shara, and I think that's essentially one of the reasons why the Kirshara was so important to Vulcan, and how it is that the Kirshara really helped usher in this golden age of Vulcan, because it did contain the knowledge, part of which being this understanding of one's Katra and how those metaphysical things work in concert with, you know, the physical being. I think that knowledge was very important. And it occurs to me that wouldn't necessarily be unique to Vulcans, but if we use the Next Generation's theory that we were all seeded from the same species, then it would be true for Cardassians, it would be true for Romulans, it would be true for humans, it would be true
why don't humans do this all the Klingon time? They didn't get the decoder ring?
They didn't get the Kirshara, man. maybe that's why Michael Burnham is so special. We don't really know yet, but she's obviously unique.
Well,
go ahead.
I don't think this really answers the philosophical question of it, but it might answer the sociological question of it. For the Vulcans, there's something almost Gnostic about this knowledge. Like, this is a secret kind of knowledge that the Vulcans either rediscovered or only the Vulcans have. They don't share. There's kind of a cultish aspect to it. You know, it's similar to, the Gnostic, let's see how to put it. It's similar to like the Neoplatonic Gnostics in early Christian theology, or similar to, say, like the Rosicrucian movement in the 19th century, right? There is something kind of esoteric and secret about this Vulcan knowledge that maybe other people could achieve, and maybe Michael Burnham has access to it because she was raised as a Vulcan and she was let into the fold in some way. So is the fact that Vulcans can do this kind of thing, you know, transfer their Katras and achieve something like immortality, and humans and Cardassians don't seem to be able to do that every day, is that a matter of metaphysics? Like, it's metaphysically impossible because they don't have a Katra and Vulcans do? Or is it more like a secret kind of Gnostic knowledge that only Vulcans have achieved and other people could achieve in principle if they were let into the fold or attained the right kind of knowledge, or they got the decoder ring?
I think in order to answer that question, we'd have to do quite a bit of speculation, and I don't really want to do that.
But I do want to
say,
sure there's nothing speculative about this discussion, Mike. What are you talking about?
I do want to say that everything about Vulcan society seems very Gnostic. In fact, in this episode, and I don't want to get away from our discussion about Vulcan Katras, but inside this episode, Leafy, that we've kind of hinged this conversation upon to some small degree, there is this problem with Sarek and this shame that he's hiding, and that is that he was confronted about the fact that his son is not quite a Vulcan, to quote the Vulcan minister, and this ward, Michael Burnham, is not quite a Vulcan. And that has caused Sarek something to be proud of and something to be ashamed of. And I know that those are human emotions, but they are truly emotions that Sarek possesses inside this episode. He is both proud and ashamed because this Vulcan minister has pointed out that what Vulcan has to offer really isn't for these not quite Vulcans, but they cannot ignore the fact that Spock being half Vulcan and Michael Burnham being human, that Sarek has done something exceptional with both of these. So they force a choice upon Sarek. We'll take one of your not quite Vulcans, but not both of them.
It's interesting you mentioned Spock, because we tend to overlook the obvious that Spock is not Vulcan. He's half Vulcan. So he's half Vulcan, but he seems to have a full Katra. So are Katras like something you can inherit genetically? Did he get the Katra gene? Like, why does he have a full Katra if he's only half Vulcan? What does that even mean?
Well, in Enterprise, up until the Forge trilogy, all of us who are fans know, but in universe, it's clear that there are some Vulcans out there who don't believe that every Vulcan can meld, when in truth, every Vulcan does possess the ability to do it.
Well, those Vulcans are just wrong about that, right?
They're just wrong.
Right.
Yeah. So I think to answer your question, I don't think there's a Cotra gene. I don't think there's a, you know, I don't think there's a gene for that. I think it's implied. I think there's an implication here, Zachary. I guess my point is that this is not unique to Vulcans. But the knowledge and understanding of it is, and they seem to be hell-bent on preserving that.
I'm going to run a truly like philosophy 101 thought experiment on this. So Spock is half human. Suppose Spock had had children, and he has children with a human woman. His children would be a quarter Vulcan. And if they had children with human partners, those children would be 1/8 human and 1/16 and 1/32 and so on. So by extension, does each one of those subsequent generations of fractional Vulcans have a full Cotra in Sarek's sense and in Spock's sense, in the classical Vulcan sense? Or is it lost somewhere along the way? So given that kind of, you know, quantitative thought experiment here, if Cotras are unique to Vulcans, what aspect of being Vulcan conveys having a Cotra? Like, where does it come from? What is it attached to? We don't really know. So if that's not a plausible scenario, like, you know, each successively less Vulcan generation of part Vulcans still has a Cotra, if we don't think that's plausible, is it more plausible to say that anyone, human or Vulcan or otherwise, has a Cotra, and it is a matter of training and esoteric mystical knowledge, but something that anyone could do, even fractional Vulcans or even non-Vulcans? Is that a more plausible interpretation of the fact that Spock has a Cotra, even though he's half Vulcan, or, you know, his children would have a Cotra if they were only a quarter Vulcan? Is that a more plausible explanation, or is a Cotra handed down through some sort of innate Vulcanness through some mechanism we've yet to figure out?
Well, I think that's a fascinating question. I think it's a tomato-tomato sort of thing, in that, you know, for the Klingon, it's the Klingon heart.
Well, no, these are two different things. We're talking about an actual Vulcan Cotra. We're not talking about, right? Those are two very different interpretations. If everyone has one versus only Vulcans have them, those don't mean the same thing.
But
right?
But to my point that this isn't unique to Vulcans.
But the ability to transfer your Cotra or preserve your Cotra seems to be unique to Vulcans, or at least Vulcans and a few others.
It certainly does, but again, I think it's plausible to say that this is that Gnostic knowledge that the Vulcan people seem to keep a tight grip on.
I have got to get a copy of the Secret Vulcan Handbook.
I would love to have a copy of the Kirshara.
start open up those boxes of Vulcan Cracker Jacks, find the secret decoder ring.
You got to get your decoder. That's exactly right, Zachary. You need your Vulcan decoder ring.
Yeah, I got to get one of those. So, of course, this is all completely speculative, but I think what I want to draw out is how much philosophical work there is to do, even in these hypothetical situations. You know, it's too easy to say, well, of course Vulcans have a Cotra, and of course they can transfer. Like, well, what does that mean? What's the mechanism? What are the rules? What are the philosophical problems? What are the objections? There's a lot of really interesting philosophical thought experiments we ran with something completely fictional, like a Vulcan Cotra.
Well, there's definitely some type of touch telepathy that goes on, but I think we've now demonstrated inside of Discovery that they don't even need touch. It's something that can cross the boundaries of the galaxy.
Well, it's not, though, because it's not like spooky action at a distance. Like, remember before there was a robust account of gravity? Gravity was taken to be something like action at a distance. These two objects affect each other across space when there's nothing connecting them, right? That was unacceptable because it sounded irrational. And it took Einstein's theory of relativity to explain that there is a connection between the two, namely the fabric of space-time, that the presence of objects in space-time is a connection between them. So it's not spooky action at a distance. There is actually a mechanism by which this interaction that we call gravity happens. So what does that mean for Vulcan, either touch telepathy, but here I'm thinking of discovery, mind melds by remote, right?
That goes back to Stamets and his comment about this superhighway that connects consciousness and all life.
Yeah, because there's one of two things has to happen. If mind melds by remote are possible, either it is metaphysical action at a distance, and that, whatever that means, right? In the same kind of sense that gravity seemed like it was action at a distance until a mechanism was figured out, or there's some sort of mechanism. There is some connection that binds them together in some way, whether it's subspace radio communication, whether it's this network that Stamets is describing, but there has to be a mechanism. Otherwise, you're back in the realm of spooky metaphysical action at a distance, which on the face sounds irrational. So you have to kind of give the writers of Discovery props here, because they could have just said, oh, now mind melds happen by remote and that's how it works now, and that's the end of the story, right? Which leaves all of the open questions like, well, how is that possible? What's the mechanism? They could have left it hanging, but instead they're trying to say, well, no, that actually wouldn't make sense. There has to be some sort of mechanism. There has to be something that connects the two together in some mechanistic kind of way. And that's what allows it to be possible. The same thing that makes the spore drive possible, right? I guess. Am I right about this? That the thing that makes the spore drive possible is also what makes the mind meld possible. Is this what they're claiming?
I think that there is a similarity in technologies. Yes, and I thought it was really neat, just from an aesthetic perspective. I think it's really neat that this neural enhancer, as Michael Burnham called it, does touch on all of the points of the face that a Vulcan would touch during a mind meld. I thought that was really cool.
I didn't really pick up on that.
It was a very cool looking device. Stamets referred to it as a synthetic mind meld augment, so that the touch points on the face were identical to where a Vulcan would touch it when initiating a mind meld. So I thought aesthetically that was pretty cool. So literally, and again, back to his statement, because I love the science of this statement. He says, in very simple terms, we boost your neural impulses to reconnect with Cerex Katra, then pump those same signals into your noggin, and voila, Cerex vision.
So that's not so much information transfer, and it's not so much spooky metaphysical Katra transfer. We're talking more like we do when we're podcasting, like streaming audio video connection.
Yeah, I think there are some similarities there, except you're dealing with, in this case, neural impulses. Whatever.
Yeah, right. It's not floppy disk. It's not like you're making a copy of someone and, you know, plugging it into someone else. You're not transferring some non-physical entity anywhere else. You're talking about two consciousnesses, one that Cerex somewhere else, either in his body or floating in space somewhere. And we have Michael Burnham's over here on Discovery or on the shuttlecraft. And there's a network between them, well, you know, a communication network. But
think,
it's not like
think ham radio.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking space ham radio, but we're not talking about Sarek's consciousness actually leaving Cerex and being in Michael Burnham, either in whole or in part. We're talking about two consciousnesses in two different places and some sort of communication network between the two. But the two consciousnesses are still separate and where they are.
I think, frankly, they could probably mass produce these augments and sell them, and it could literally become like Vulcan ham radio.
Well, I guess I worry that maybe we're making too big of a problem out of this. Like when I talk to you while we're podcasting over our Zoom audio chat that we use, Zoom audio video chat that we use to record the podcast, and when I talk to someone on the ham radio, I don't think of my consciousness as going along with me. My consciousness is still right here. I don't think of someone else's consciousness as coming through the airwaves and all of a sudden sitting here in my podcast studio, right? I literally think there are two consciousnesses in two different places, and it's just a matter of communication. But when we're talking about leaving a part of someone behind in the process of a mind meld, that seems different from ordinary communication protocols.
I'm actually sitting here a little disturbed at the thought that every time we have one of these conversations, and this is
the, I'm right there with you, Mike.
This is the 81st one that we've had together, Zachary, that a little bit of you is being left behind every time.
Man, there's not going to be much of me left before you know it. I better be careful. We shouldn't do this too often.
After a couple of hundred of these, man, what's left, you know?
Yeah, mind melds are kind of a degenerative disease that way. Every time you do one, you leave a little bit of yourself behind.
Well, Zachary, with that, I think we just leave it to the delegates of the Babel Conference. And again, I want to extend an invitation. This conversation isn't over. We're not even going to do final thoughts today because the conversation continues on the Babel Conference. So find our show thread over on the Babel Conference and jump in and get involved. Let's discuss this.
You're saying make a Katra deposit in the Babel Conference?
We're inviting our delegates to make our listeners to make a Katra deposit in the Babel Conference. Absolutely. My mind to your mind, my thoughts to your thoughts. Just share away and let our minds become one.
Those Katra deposits pay pretty good interest, I hear. Over time. Yeah.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Katras today in the Star Trek universe, but that isn't the only thing we've been discussing here on the network. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Warp 5.
Who is that musician band like that with the Greeblies?
The what?
Who are those weird looking neighbors that the Flintstones had? Like those monster neighbors? The Greeblies?
Wow. I forget. That's a deep cut right there.
I was about to say, dude, that's like 4 years old deep right there.
Yeah.
To the journey!
I kind of figured he would just be able to, like, make another mobile emitter for the Doctor. Wouldn't he?
He'd use his nanoprobes for that.
Yeah.
Right, put some nanoprobes on the job, they'll make the Doctor a new mobile emitter.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Lickety-split.
Can I have my mobile emitter? Oh, yeah. He never asked, though, did he?
No, he didn't.
If he'd asked him, he'd just been like, oh, yeah, here you go.
Primitive Culture. A look at history and culture through Star Trek.
There is very much in Star Trek a kind of essentially moral worldview that is pertaining culturally in that world in the same way as, you know, say in the Arthurian court, you have this kind of moral world.
You sound like you're agreeing with Dr. McCoy that this is medievalism.
Nothing wrong with medievalism.
As you were talking.
Good medievalism, you know.
Literary Treks.
Yeah, you know, I think I made what little hints I gave in previous books about who had done it and why. I left sort of vague, but there were a couple of details that I had to hit because I'd seeded them in earlier novels.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Well, check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please, leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, well, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps, pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts. You can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to mind meld with us. The best place to join the larger conversation is always the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. It is a closed group, but if you click join, one of our admins will let you right on in. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select MetaTreks. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/ Trek FM. Well, Zachary, when you're not playing with your synthetic mind meld augment, where can our listeners find you around Trek FM and on the interwebs?
Man, if I had one of those, I wouldn't do anything else. Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts over there, Suzanne Williamson and Kay Shaw. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me over there. And you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not busy scouring the libraries looking for that secret Vulcan handbook, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Zachary, you can always find me around Facebook. That's where I'm most active. I always enjoy talking to our delegates, our listeners in the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is at cmichael1701, Instagram cmichael1701. And there's always my blog about my journey to publish my novel and a little bit about life. That's cmichael1701.wordpress.com. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, consider becoming a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include things like early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, there's so many more, available all through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Zachary, as always, we want to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from around the network, specifically. We'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. I want to give a special thank you and a shout out to our associate producers here on Metatrex, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, your co-host over at To the Journey, and our good friend here on Metatrex, her Twitter handle is at Choco Weeble. And our good friend Norm Lau, you can connect with him also on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at Starfighter1701. And Mark Walker out there in Parts Unknown.
And those are the most indivisible Katras I know.
And Zachary, we'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Just visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.